Blog Talk Radio.
Praise and thanks. Mojuba Akoda, Mojuba Asheda, Mojuba Aluami, Apolabi Pega, Mojuba Araba Mi, Adesanya Awuyade, Mojuba Ogute Compound Oje Remo, Mojuba Baba, Mojuba Yeye, Mojuba Egun to all the God children, Mojuba Egun to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba Egungun to all the chiefs, Mojuba Egungun to all the Awos, Mojuba Egungun to all those that are listening, who are tuned in. We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe,
Ashe,
Ashe,
Ashe. Welcome to Sign of the Times, everyone. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by the UAC, United African Coalition for Justice and Human Rights, and, of course, New Power Radio Network. We began the UAC after the unjust Thurman verdict of July 2013, and we welcome you to our ninth season here on the air at Sign of the Times Blog Talk Radio. We ask that you support our sponsors, Manhood, Race, and Culture, headed up by Dr. James Jones. You can reach out to Dr. Jones on Facebook as Manhood, Race, and Culture, the Like and Group page, and, of course, on the World Wide Web at manhoodraceculture.com. Also support the People's Platform for Equality and Justice. Based here out of Cincinnati, Ohio, we have an active campaign going to restore the power back to the people. And it's all about restorative justice, everybody. So tonight we're going to have a listen and learn session with our honorable lawyer, Dr. Claude Anderson, speaking on inappropriate behavior. Now, this was originally recorded in approximately 2013 or so, but Dr. Anderson was so on point with what he was predicting as an economist, as someone who looks at politics, as someone who is a strategist, and realized that we were headed for exactly where we are right now, brothers and sisters. We see just yesterday, gas was 35 cents cheaper than it was today. And it's just the beginning of things to come. So the more that we do to empower ourselves, the more that we do to empower our children and teach them to be independent, grow our own food, grow our own vegetables, you know, eat a green-based diet versus trying to buy, you know, what has become a luxury almost, which is a meat. And just take on an overall new outlook, if you will, on, you know, where we're possibly headed as a community if we choose to continue to do the things that we're already doing. So enjoy tonight's Listen and Learn session. I first want to start off with Robert Reich speaking on racism is profitable, and then I'm going to get into the Listen and Learn with Dr. Claude Anderson speaking on inappropriate behavior. So this video or audio is available on YouTube. You should look to find it yourself, but enjoy tonight's Listen and Learn session, everybody, and get your pen and paper out because you know it's going to be some interesting things that are going to be said that we should be really, 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 really looking at. So thank you for listening. Thank you for your support. If you need to reach out to me, I can be reached on social media as Queen Tahira, Sign O the Times, and, of course, New Power Radio Network and Kabuka Publishing, Inc. We do have a calendar out right now that's on Amazon, so please support us so we can continue to support you. So tonight, here goes tonight's Listen and Learn session, starting off with Robert Reich speaking on racism being profitable, and then we're going to go into the Honorable Warrior, Dr. Claude Anderson. Enjoy tonight's session, everybody. I'll talk to you soon. Peace.
Since the first colonizers arrived in the United States to this very moment, wealthy elites have used the tools of theft, exclusion, and exploitation to expand their wealth and power to the detriment of Black, Latinx, Indigenous people, and marginalized people of color. It all boils down to this simple truth. Racism is profitable.
The profitability of racism sparks a vicious cycle called the oppression economy. Elite institutions are motivated to suppress the economic vitality of people of color. That economic oppression in turn hinders our political power, and that political oppression kneecaps our ability to change the system. This cycle plays out in every aspect of the economy, and is particularly apparent in mass incarceration. The criminalization of people of color is a multi-billion dollar industry. In 2017 alone, mass incarceration cost $182 billion, trapping mostly low-income Black and Latinx people in a cycle of economic and political disenfranchisement.
If we follow the money, we find that some of America's largest banks, including Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and JP Morgan Chase, have all extended millions of dollars in credit lines to for-profit prison operators like Geo Group and CoreCivic. The unregulated operations of prisons has increasingly mandated cheap service for maximum profit. For example, bail bonds companies, telecommunications, food, and commissary companies gouge both those who are incarcerated and their families.
The exploitation doesn't stop upon release from prison. The suppression of our economic vitality is just the beginning. Because of discrimination, formerly incarcerated people are unemployed at a rate of 27%. Higher than the total U.S. unemployment rate during any historical period, including during this pandemic and the Great Depression. Fines and fees associated with the criminal justice system have placed $50 billion in debt on the shoulders of approximately 10 million people who have been through the system. To make matters worse, many states bar people convicted of felonies from receiving any government assistance. And that's just incarceration. Over the past four decades, the cost of policing in the U.S. has skyrocketed, almost tripling from $42.3 billion in 1977 to $114.5 billion in 2017. Of the 100 largest cities in America, the nine police forces that kill people at the highest rate per population all take up over 30% of their city's budget, leaving paltry resources to invest in housing, education, and healthcare.
This deliberate economic oppression suppresses our political power, weakening our constitutional right to change the rules of a system that regulates whether or not profit can be derived from racism. In our current system, the wealthy elite use their purchased political power to manipulate the system for their own gain at the expense of people of color. Let's turn back to people who are incarcerated. In 48 states, those who are currently or formerly incarcerated face restrictions on their right to vote, yet inmates count as residents of where they are incarcerated rather than their hometowns. That means people in prison have no representation and are used as pawns to skew representational power towards the largely white rural areas that house those prisons. That leaves incarcerated people's hometowns underrepresented.
The restrictions on voting power don't end upon release. 6.1 million people are prevented from casting a ballot due to a prior felony conviction. And over four times as many black people have lost their right to vote due to felony disenfranchisement than non-black people.
It's a never-ending cycle that has been churning for centuries. The profitability of racism motivates elite institutions to continue economic oppression that in turn hinders our political power. And that political oppression kneecaps our ability to change the system in which racism is so profitable.
So how do we break the cycle? Let's start with supporting candidates and pressuring elected officials at every level of government who will support bold policies that dismantle the oppression economy and build a liberation economy and remove those that don't. To end the oppression economy, our government must end the criminalization of people of color, end our political suppression, and curb runaway corporate power.
And to build a liberation economy, our government must guarantee that all people of color have access to basic economic rights, like a guaranteed income and employment, universal health care, guaranteed housing, a free college education, and generational wealth. This liberation economy is within our power to create. As Teddy Roosevelt said, we are the government. It does not belong to the corporations and the plutocrats that currently control them. It belongs to us, and it is within our power to take it back.
We can break this cycle if we act together.
Let's get to work.
Black folks will be going into that underclass structure starting in about another 2 years. Once we go into it, we'll be locked and frozen in it by the year 2013 or 2010, that general time frame. All of us got about 2 years to either get our act together or hang it up. If we don't do some very specific things in that next 2 year period, we will not get out of it. That window's going to close on us. Now, what's going to drive us into this underclass structure? First of all, are the legacies of slavery and Jim Crowism. We are still bearing the burdens and the scars. They were never corrected. That's one of the failings of our leadership in this country. They had the nerve, the audacity, to let black folks suffer for 460 years. And at the end of the Civil Rights Movement, rather than going back and saying, let's find out what has happened to black folk for 460 years, have they been psychologically, emotionally, politically, educationally damaged? Nobody spent 1 minute of time trying to figure out what had happened to black folk over all that period of time. So in the course of the Civil Rights Movement, at the end of it, they say, well, let's pretend that nothing has happened to them, that they were not injured, they were not hurt, and now let's go seek integration and pretend that we're all equal. Now, that was grossly unfair, because by that point in time, and by the 1966 period, whites had become economic giants in America. They owned and controlled everything at that point in time. Black folk didn't own anything. Whites controlled almost 100% of all the wealth, the income, the privileges, the businesses, the resources, and all levels of government. Blacks had nothing. Blacks were one-foot midgets. And they allowed us then to use integration to walk from our communities, from our ghettos, over in their communities, totally disarmed, not understanding anything, blind, naked, and then saying that you can go and compete. Compete with what? And that's what's happening in South Africa right now, where you have black folk now who have been totally subjected to the most brutal form of legal and economic slavery around the world for almost 300 years in South Africa, where whites in South Africa control almost 100% of all the gold mines, the diamond mines, the chrome, the bauxite, the magnesium, the land, the businesses, the farms, the animals. And now in South Africa, they've been told that they're free. Now, anybody in his right mind would have said, hold it a second. Now, if there's been a reform in South Africa, since whites have gotten everything and blacks got nothing, you should have seen on the news a massive flux of whites trying to get out of South Africa. If there's going to be any significant real change, wouldn't you agree? Somebody would have been trying to get out of there. The airports would have been jammed. And you all haven't heard a peep. You know why? Because nothing is changing. Because in South Africa, the dominant, arrogant white society that's been so brutal to black folks still owns and controls 100% of all the gold mines, diamond mines, silver mines, chrome, bauxite. And they're telling those South Africans, you can now compete. And that's the problem in black America. We've been told now that we can compete, and I say, well, with what? And by going into our underclass structure, going to be converging factors going to push us. To get my little summary up, one, we're going to have an increased amount of conservatism in the country, and I'm going to talk about conservatism in a few minutes. Two, we're going to have a massive unending influx of immigrants into the country. They're going to push us down. We have been the number two population in America now for over 460 years. We're going to get kicked out of being number two and going down to number three. When are we going to go down to number three? We're going to go down to number three in less than 2 years. Now, when I wrote my book about 4 or 5 years ago, Hispanics at that time were 9% of the population. They've now moved in 6 years from 9% up to 11%. Blacks were 12.3% 6 years ago. They're still at 12.3%. Now you got a Hispanics at 11 and blacks at 12.3. According to the Census Bureau 2 weeks ago in Washington, D.C., they anticipate Hispanics passing blacks right on time, as I had predicted. Now, Wall Street Journal, the left-hand column 2 weeks ago, on the left-hand side of the page, I can send it to you if you want, it says that when Hispanics pass black people, at that time, the whole political structure would shift gears. There'd be a power shift in America. That nobody's going to go to black folk to ask them anything anymore because you're no longer the dominant minority population. They are already preparing for this. They're already creating all kinds of major programs around the country where they would go and check with Hispanics about anything they want to know about minorities. Black folk would get their information through the Hispanic Society. Then by the year 2005, the Asians are going to pass black folk. Then you're going to get kicked from being number three down to number four. At that point in time, you're locked in and frozen because everything you need will have to pass through those two groups. And those two groups do not have your interest at heart. They don't understand your problems and don't care about it. If you can't compete, they're going to say, that's tough. And so what we're going to try to do today in dealing with that one issue, as well as conservatism and the problems of technology in America that's also going to push us in the underclass, is to teach you how to compete. We got to understand we got these problems, but you got to understand where the problems came from. And I want to give you a real fast education today, because the real cue, the real clue to liberation is not only education, it's re-education. And that's what we're going to talk about this morning. I'm going to show you how we got into our dilemma and how we must get out of it. Nothing has happened to black folk by accident. Everything that's happened to you has been systematically programmed through what I call social engineering. You are a victim of historical social engineering. Now let's go back and start dealing with some of these issues. And a lot of this would you also find covered in my book, Black Labor, White Wealth, and the other two books I got coming out this year. One is called Dirty Little Secrets, and the big one is called Powernomics, How Do You Do It? And Powernomics, if you want to know what Powernomics is, because I'm going to talk about it a little later, Powernomics is teaching my people how a new way of seeing, thinking, and behaving. And that's what the whole thing will be about this morning. You got to change the way you're seeing, thinking, and behaving. Why? Because I said we've been locked into an underclass structure. Because we got two major problems in America. One problem is that maldistribution of wealth and resources I told you about that's in South Africa and America where whites own and control everything. That's your number one problem. The second problem we're going to talk about this morning is the inappropriate behavior pattern of black folk. Those are the only two problems you have. I don't care what anybody else talks about in America. It's not worthwhile wasting your time. The problem in America is not drug abuse, crime, low-income housing, public housing, food stamps, welfare, teenage pregnancy. Those are symptoms of a problem. The symptoms are the fact that you don't own and control anything to run you and control your lives. That's the problem. And the second thing is inappropriate behavior patterns. And before I get into inappropriate behavior patterns, let me define that for you. Now, I'm in current day terms, I might call it the Rodney King syndrome. It's pretty familiar to most of you. That's when somebody pulls you out of a car, breaks your jaw, breaks three ribs, cracks two, knocks out two teeth, gives you a concussion, breaks your wrist, breaks your kneecap, and stomps you, and you say, why can't we all get along? That is inappropriate behavior. Or if I'm in Detroit, Michigan, as when I was there functioning as an assistant police commissioner during the riot, and I was working on riot possibilities and techniques in the city, I get a call down to by some people who had been involved in a couple of murders. And he said, look, I didn't have anything to do with it, Anderson. I just there, I witnessed it. I said, what happened? Well, you see, they'd had a disturbance in Detroit, Michigan, and the police broke into a motel and found two black boys in there with some white girls. And they didn't like that, even though they were in a black neighborhood. They had paid for the room. It was their right and privilege to be wherever they wanted to be. It was between them and God. But the police officers were white. They were very disturbed about this. So what they did, they took those two boys on a Friday, and they beat them all day Friday. And they beat them all day Saturday. Then by Sunday, they had gotten tired of beating them. They said, well, we just go ahead and kill them. And so one of the officers picked up a rifle, and hit the oldest black kid in the back of the head with a rifle. And the kid was only about 22 years of age. Hit him so hard that it knocked one eye completely out of socket and bulged the other eye and broke the rifle stock. And the poor kid fell on his knees and crawled around and found the broken stock of the rifle and on his knees held it up and apologized for having a hard head. That is inappropriate behavior. The question should have been, why are you brutalizing me and killing me? What have I done to you? And so that's the kind of inappropriate behavior. It's what we've been systematically programming to displaying as black folk in a very highly competitive society. So what I want you all to start thinking about today and all throughout my speech today is not who you're against, but who you're for. I want you to understand that you're in a very highly competitive situation. You're going to be competing to survive and prosper. And that's what racism is all about. Contrary to what anybody tells you, and I just saw a definition of racism in the Washington Post last week by a noted columnist who's a conservative. And what he was really talking about was prejudice and discrimination. He wasn't talking about racism, but he was mystifying the word. That's why I finally figured out why he's always on the wrong side of an issue relating to black folk. He thinks that a black person can be racist. A black person cannot be a racist. Racism is a power relationship between groups of people. That's all it is. It means where one group of people have control of so much wealth and power and resource that it can deprive, hurt, and injure, and exploit another group to benefit itself. Never in the history of this earth have black folk ever controlled that much resources and where they can have gone out of their way to exploit, injure, and do something to whites. So therefore, racism only started in the 16th century when you began to commercialize slavery against blacks. That's when racism started. There was no such thing as racism before that. The other thing, and before I get into my presentation, you got to understand racism also comes from the word race. Race means group. So whenever you hear people talking about now, you cannot prove racism because somebody fired you from a job, they are absolutely right. And the power structure and all the white think tanks in Washington know that. That's why you can no longer prove racism, because racism does not apply to an individual. It applies to a group. And because I discriminate against you, that's individual, that's personal. It's not group-based, and so you can no longer prove group-based discrimination. The second thing about the word race, remember also, which is very important for our discussion today, is the word race means being in competition. See, they didn't pick house, tree, car. They said racism. Race means being where people are competing from here to there. And we are in competition. That's what racism means. Black people must learn how to compete or survive and survive or not compete and perish. And so this morning we're going to start talking about what we got to do. Now let's go back to when all this, when everybody said, where did this start? Let's go back to where it started. It all started in Africa. And as I go through all this, I want you all to keep some points. And I stick my finger up in there, remember those points. Those are the points going to be hurting us today. Those same points I'm going to articulate to you today. Now, all this started in Africa. Let's say about 1441. There was a guy called Henry the Navigator who went around the coast of Africa, and he found some slaves and traded some slaves off. And he brought them back to Europe. And he took them back to Europe, and he gave them to the Pope as gifts. And the Pope and the Catholic Church were so beautifully appreciative of these slaves that he then said, since you've given me these slaves, what I'm going to do now is award you 300 miles of the coastline of West Africa, which is now called the Gold Coast. So Henry the Navigator was given land by the Pope, the Catholic Pope, and the Catholic Pope didn't even own the land. But he gave him all the rights of 300 miles of coastlines of West Africa. Said, it belongs to you. That was in 1441. And so and Henry the Navigator was a Portuguese. So he began to then to try to encourage other Portuguese to go around and try to find some more slaves. So this is a good thing. We own all that land around there now. By 1487, the Pope then said, aha, so many people began to pick up slaves. He says, what I'm going to do now is put out a public declaration and officially declare slavery to be a legitimate enterprise. And the Catholic Church was the first one to do it. Now, why is this important? Because you see, up until that point in time, slavery was never based on skin color. Slavery was based on three things to put you into slavery. One was an indebtedness where you owed somebody something and not paid at all. Two was that you were through religious persecution. Or three, you were a prisoner of a war or conflict and you were now a captive and they were forcing you into labor. Those were the only three reasons you could get into slavery until the Catholic Church put out this declaration. And now they added a fourth variable which says color is now a factor. Now that's very important because the Catholic Church now had in previous slavery, in earlier parts immediately after Christ was born, the Catholic Church played a very pivotal role and saying, as a religious institution, we got an obligation to represent those who are enslaved. And the Catholic Church set up a system that they would go through, whether it was a Greek slave or a Roman slave, they looked after the rights of the enslaved, protect them, saying that even if you're a slave, there are certain things that people cannot do to you. The Catholic Church accepted that responsibility. Now the Catholic Church now has condoned black enslavement based on skin color. That was totally different. But also, the first thing they did, they abandoned any interest in representing the interests of the enslaved, even though they had done it for everyone else. And all of a sudden, the problems began to develop in Africa. Other religions began to join in. So people say, well, Dr. Anderson, how were they able to enslave us? Because we were doing some things wrong in Africa. As the other religions joined in to start enslaving blacks, so did other nations, so did other ethnic groups. And black folk were totally ill-prepared to deal with it because we had been doing some things wrong in Africa ourselves. See, going back to about 765, the Muslims had been trying to get into Africa for the longest because they'd heard about all the gold and silver and the wealth in Africa. And the Muslims had been going around, the Arabs had been going around Africa trying to conduct holy wars against dark-skinned people to get access to the resources. And starting in 765, not 17, but in 765, the Arabs started enslaving black folk. They enslaved on an average of 1 million blacks every 100 years and shipped them out of Africa. So now if you start accounting from 765 up to the present day, that's over 1,300 years. That means over 13 million blacks have been shipped out of Africa just by the Arabs alone. And the Arabs are still shipping blacks out to slavery. If you go to Ethiopians and Mauritania, you'll now find, in Sudan, you still find blacks being sold by Arabs for about $475 a piece. So Arabs have been selling blacks now for over 1,300 years. So but when you get around to 900, so a few years after, 200 years after that, the Arabs are still trying to penetrate the blacks to get their wealth. And blacks have got an international reputation being one of the wealthiest nations on earth, talking about walking on streets of gold. And so from 900 up until about 1400, they live reasonably well because people were afraid to penetrate Africa. Because blacks also had a ferocious reputation for being invincible fighters. They were scared of the jungles and the black warriors. So no one went into Africa to get them, but the Arabs were still trying to get in, get access to the wealth and resources. Now I'm back up to the 14th century again. Now in the 1400s, about the same time as I just told you that the Pope declared that officially that blacks can be enslaved, at the same time Timbuktu was invaded by the Arabs. They finally broke through. They broke through because, see, blacks at that time had three major empires, Ghana, Mali, and Songhe. They were the richest nation on earth, but the black leadership had set themselves up to be invaded by the Arabs and consensus to be pimped. Because the black leadership was extremely naive, going around practicing what I call benign slavery. Every time anybody came into an African nation, like Mali, Songhe, what they were saying is that, well, I'll do business with you, but you got to buy one of my slaves. And the slaves were their own people. And they were playing games with slavery, saying, well, it's a tribe, he's a different tribe, so I'll enslave him. But the slavery that blacks were practicing was not the same vicious kind of slavery that came later. But the fact that they were playing with it, condoning it, and willing to sell their own black folk out naively. Now the question becomes, why were they doing it? Okay? Why were they doing it? They were doing it trying to impress people with their power, how strong they were, saying that I would do business with you, but let me show you how strong I am. I got three or four blacks in the back room, and you buy them from me, and then I'll sell you some gold and silver. And what people were impressed with was not really their power. They were impressed with the fact that you had absolutely no interest as a leader in your own people and felt no responsibility to their welfare. And so when that got out, then all those countries, as I said, once the Pope condoned slavery, they began to flow into Africa because they knew the black leadership did not feel the strong togetherness, the willingness to protect their own people and to look out for them and lead them and would willingly sacrifice them. So Africa fell wide open. And people poured into Africa after the Pope declared slavery legal in the 1480s. By 1500, between 1500 and 1650, 150 years, they hauled out 5 million blacks just to Central America alone, just right south of here into Mexico and Central America, Costa Rica. Just to give you an example, after the Pope declared that you can legally go after those blacks, they pulled out 5 million of them and sent them in there. And those blacks, in 150 years, with sticks and stones, not steam shovels, but with sticks and stones and rocks, dug out over 16,000 tons of silver and 400 tons of gold just to enrich Spain and Portugal. And this was critically important because at that point in time, Africa was a rich continent, had all kinds of wealth, and Europe was an impoverished nation. Europe was run over with crime, sickness, disease, illness, disorganized. Africa was the glory of the world. But you see, our people were playing around, not looking out, taking care of the business of their people. At that point in time, all these nations say, aha, we know how to strengthen Europe and rebuild Europe. And that's by displacing the wealth out of Africa and displacing not only the material wealth, but the human wealth of Africa. So they began to pour in and started sucking blacks out of Africa. Not only the black treasures, the gold, the silver, but also the human capital. In some areas, they almost depopulated parts of Africa by shipping blacks out. And over a course of about another 300 years, they shipped out somewhere between 25 and 30 million, 35 million blacks. And out of all those blacks that shipped out of Africa, over two-thirds of them died en route trying to get here. As a matter of fact, from the 1500s to 1800s, six out of every seven people that were shipped across, came across the Atlantic Ocean were black folk. Six out of seven were blacks. And they were depopulating Africa, not only as wealth, as resources, but as human capital. Very important. And as they came into the, and as they shipped them out, everybody began to become enriched. But you still had black leadership that still didn't understand, unwittingly was playing into the hands of people who were much more serious about the games than they were. So I jump up to the year 1619, they brought in 20 blacks into America, formally, even though we'd had another group of blacks in here around in the 1500s. They've been floating around, too, off of PD River in South Carolina. And we'd had blacks much earlier, the Folsom people. But let me not even get into that. But by 1619, they brought in 21 blacks into Jamestown, formally. And those blacks came in as indentured servants. They were traded by a German warship for supplies. Those blacks were free in about year 1624. But something very important happened right before 1624. In 1621, you had a black guy named Anthony Johnson. Anthony Johnson came to the United States in 1621, came in from England as a free black. At the same time, you had those other 20 black slaves brought in here in 1619, the first 20 blacks. But this black came in as a free black in 1621. He came in, and then since he was coming in from England, not from Africa, he then declared himself a free black, declared that he wanted head rights. And head rights in those days says anybody coming to the country can get 640 acres free right off the bat. Then plus you can get another 500 to 600 acres for every slave that you own. He immediately went and had 13 blacks. He brought in then, we got him 13 black slaves. He's black. So within a few years, about 15 years, he was one of the richest blacks in the colonies. But he was enslaving his own people. Now, going up to 1638, Maryland Colony then put out a public edict that laid the cornerstone for racism in this country, saying that now that black folks coming into this country and they began to intermingle with whites and socialize like Johnson and trying to integrate, we got to pass a new law. So the state of Maryland put out a law called the Doctrine of Exclusion. The Doctrine of Exclusion says that no black shall be permitted to enjoy the fruits of white society. That was in 1638. Now, Johnson was still had it. He's really built up his land now. He had all kinds of land and a whole bunch of slaves, getting close to about 70, 80 slaves now. And a white guy went over to one of his plantations. And one of the black slaves there, named John Castor, asked him, says, why am I a slave here with this guy? He says, I didn't know that. He says, he owns me for life. How does he own me for life? And the white fellow who was a plantation owner also said, look, he doesn't own you for life. You know, didn't you contract for indentured servantship? Indentured servantship normally runs 5 or 7 years. What do you mean he's got you for life? This black guy said, I've been working for this Anthony Johnson, this black slave plantation owner, for almost 20-something years. The guy said, well, just run off and leave. Forget about him. You don't have to keep working for him. So the black slave, John Castor, ran off. But guess what happened? Anthony Johnson then went to court, and he sued the white plantation owner who had encouraged the black to run off. Sued him in court, and the court accepted Anthony Johnson's claim against his black slave, saying that he owned that slave for life. Now, what happened there never had ever happened on the history of the earth with black folk and in this country, where all of a sudden a person laid claims against an individual for the rest of his entire naked life. And it was a black man. And once that court decision was made, whites picked it up and say, aha. So by 1665, all the states then started passing enslavement laws. They went back and took the Doctrine of Exclusion and say, now, the Doctrine of Exclusion with Maryland says that black folks shall always be excluded and never be permitted to enjoy the fruits of white society. But after listening to the court decision for Anthony Johnson, we got a good thing going now. So they took that same doctrine and expanded it. And now the doctrine says that not only should black folks be excluded, subordinated, non-compensated, non-competitive managed workforce for the personal comfort and wealth building of white society. That became the enslavement codes, both explicitly and implicitly. And all the states began to enact it then, based on Anthony Johnson's ruling in court that he owns another black person for life. Now the system picks up. We jump now to about 1704. 1704, there's a black kid. There are a whole bunch of slaves coming in from Africa on a slave vessel called the Eagle. The Eagle is heading towards America. There's a young black boy on there, along with some other older slaves. The slaves decide to revolt on the ship. And they took over and knocked the captain down, took over the ship, and took the weapons, and we're in a fight to take over the control of the ship and head it back towards Africa. And as one of the older slaves grabbed a machete, and he said he's going to kill the captain so they can completely have control of the ship, as he swung at the captain, a young black slave jumped up and got in the way and protected the captain and took the blows himself, which chopped off one of his arms and protected the captain. And by protecting the captain was able to recover the control of the vessel, put down the insurrection, and then hung all the blacks who were trying to revolt, except the young black kid who was only 19. When the captain got to America, he gave him to supposedly a benevolent slave owner and rewarded him with recognition and says that after he's been educated and recover from his wounds, that he's to be set free. And again, this young boy, he placed more importance on protecting other people than getting his free people out of a dilemma. But he was rewarded and recognized for it, and he personally benefited at the expense of his own people. That was in 1704. 1705, the colonies said, what we need to do now is pass slave codes so we can regulate slaves' behavior, period. Slave codes were passed to tell you exactly how every black person must act in America, what he could not do, and what every white person must do to make sure black folks stayed in line. Then they passed another law at the same time with it, which is still in effect today. It was called the Diversity Act of 1705. You all call it multicultural and cultural diversity. You all understand what I'm saying to you? I want you all to understand history. If you ever want to figure out how to get out of your dilemma, never spend your time trying to work with anything unless you know how it got into place. And then you take it out of place. The multiculturalism and cultural diversity started in 1705. They passed a law at the same time saying, how do we control black folk now? They said, now that we got all these blacks coming to the country, we got a good thing going. They said, because now all over Europe is being advertised, if you want to become wealthy and powerful, go to America. We guarantee if you go to America, we give you free land and free labor. You'd have to be an idiot not to get rich. You don't have to do anything. We'll give you all the land you want and all, and England started a franchising system, so which means even if you couldn't afford to buy slaves, we had a franchising concept, which means England would give you the land and give you the slaves. All you do is pay them a commission, just like McDonald's and Burger King. That's where the whole franchising concept came from. It was from England with slavery. And so people rushed into this country. But they had to set up external controls, saying, how do we control them when they get here? With all these blacks coming into the country. Because I just told you, 6 out of every 7 persons coming across the Atlantic were black folk. They were pouring into the country. But they want to make sure enough whites are here to benefit and get the fruits of black folks' labor. And so they passed the cultural diversity, which says, the cultural diversity law says, for every 5 blacks you own, you must have 1 white person. You must always have 1 white person there to monitor, to make sure that black folk are being monitored and kept under control, that you understand what they're up to. That law stayed into effect, never went out of effect. Now, come 1710. Now, when 1710 came, here's the main point of my talk today. 1710 did something that is totally devastating. Totally devastating. The Virginia colony in 17 passed what they call meritorious manumission. Meritorious manumission says, what we're going to do now that we put up the external controls in 1705, we must have internal controls. We don't have the time to go around and monitor and watch all these black folk coming into this country. We must build in some kind of internal management control. We must build in a way like the Rodney King syndrome, that kind of thing. And we must build into black folk an inappropriate behavior pattern. We must teach black folk to see things upside down in a non-realistic manner. And what they did very systematically was like taking glasses and painting pictures on it upside down. And we found out in laboratories in sociology and psychology that even if you paint the world upside down for a person to put glasses on their eyes, we found that the subjects can learn to live upside down. They learn how to adjust, learn how to adjust their reach and what they're doing. And we watched it over and over again in experiments with young people in school, where we paint the pictures upside down and say, what do you see? And the mind has the ability to flip things back over to where it becomes, where the reality becomes the unreal. That the unreal becomes the reality. And once you do that, you got your people nailed to the wall. So meritorious manumission came into effect in 1710 and says, we will reward, we will recognize, we will set free any black person does one of four things. One, if you in fact will save a white person's life. I told you about the young man on the boat with the eagle, you know, 5 or 6 years before that. If you save a white person's life, you will get your freedom. Two, if you protect a white person's property. Three, if you invent something that a white person can make wealth and power off of, some kind of an invention. And four, if you in fact will squeal on, inform on, or tell on your own people. That was called meritorious manumission. Now, you all might say, why is that important? I'm going to tell you, that was so devastatingly important. And the reason it was so important is because that created a magnificent control system that has never been duplicated. Never been duplicated. As a matter of fact, it has only been replicated one time that I know of, and I'm usually pretty current on most issues in this country, psychological, sociological, and educational in this country. Only one time it's been duplicated. It was duplicated in the 1950s. The communists duplicated it in Korea. They call it brainwashing. Now, you might ask, what is brainwashing? Now, typically, people in the 1950s, when it happened in the Korean War, we talked about brainwashing. See, now, I was a safety and survival engineer for my squadron. I was in a Marine attack squadron. My primary responsibility was to teach my people how to survive. We had a school for brainwashing in Barbers Point, Hawaii. Teach them how to survive. What's brainwashing? Well, most people, at least the guys in the Marine Corps, they thought that brainwashing would be some kind of a inhumane way of treating people. That it would be no less than pulling out fingernails, driving bamboo splinters between the joints, hanging people up in the cold and castrating them, what we call the Chinese water torture. But brainwashing was none of those things. It was none of those things. Brainwashing was simply a very sophisticated form of re-education. And see, for you all in the auditorium this morning, brainwashing, so that you'll always remember it, is nothing but group therapy run in reverse. We always remember that. Now, the whole point of group therapy is to bring people together. Brainwashing is to turn it backwards and scatter people apart. And that was very effective in Korea against our troops. And see, I'm going to show you the different parallels of what happened in 1710 and what happened in 1950 so you can understand the implications of what's happened to black folk in America. Otherwise, you can't deal with the issue. So in 1950, we had approximately 7,000 Americans in prisoner of war camps in North Korea and China. 7,000 Americans had been captured and put into war camps before they were subjected to brainwashing. And after they were subjected to brainwashing, starting from the time they were captured, do you know that in that course of time, almost 4 years, we did not have one single solitary American prisoner to escape from a prisoner of war camp? that had never happened in the history of this nation, that you can contain that many soldiers in one or two places and never have one to escape. Not one escaped out of 7,000 in almost 4 years. And to tell you the truth, in some of those camps, they didn't even have fences or walls up. Some of them didn't even have guards. And our people could not escape because of the techniques of brainwashing that was used on them. You would say, now, what was happening to them? They were being devastatedly re-educated. And this is the same identical technique that was used in 1710 on black folk. The whole concept of integration was the same thing that today. They scattered them. Now, what happened in Korea? In Korea, we know certain kind of things were happening to the prisoners. They didn't act like prisoners anymore. See, when a guy when he was captured as a prisoner, the first responsibility was to try to escape, not to participate, not to cooperate with the enemy, not to compromise one's principles. But to always try to fight, resist, and get out, and to compete to help your own people to escape if you can. Didn't happen in Korea. Because, you see, brainwashing, reverse technique of group therapy, first of all, what it did, it divided the soldiers against each other. Divided the soldiers against each other. And there's a whole revolutionary principle that says that a revolution comes when two people get together and begin to conspire. You can never have a revolution or an insurrection on earth as long as you drive a wedge between the first two people. You drive a wedge between the first two people, you'll never have a revolt. And in Korea, we never had a revolt. Secondly, people can only organize if they get together. But see, what the communists did, they started an information system, a squealing system, an informing system. And what we found in Korea was they had the most massive, widespread information system ever on earth, where people were recognizing other people or identifying other people who were planning on escaping. And what the communists were doing was telling people, look, you all got a responsibility now as a prisoner. If you hear about another prisoner talking about escaping, it's your responsibility to inform on him and tell on him. And if you do that, we'll reward you. You get an extra candy bar and apple. And once that happens, you see pretty soon, the soldiers didn't know who to trust anymore. They didn't know who to tell anything to. If he was planning on escaping, who did he tell? He didn't know when the other guy's going to turn him in for a reward. And so the organization broke down, and they quit communicating and sharing information to each other. Because all of a sudden you were planning on escape. Next day someone drags you out in the cold, strips you down, and pours ice water on you at 26 below zero because somebody just turned you in for an apple and a piece of candy. And see, that's what happened in meritorious manumission in 1710 when blacks were being rewarded for turning in other blacks. See, also what it does, it stops your communication, it stops your business, your ability to organize, but also it broke down what we have to have as a sense of community. In none of those camps do they have a sense of community anymore in Korea. And without a sense of community, you have no way of doing the things that have to be done as a human being. And so in the prison war camps in Korea, all of a sudden the camps became filthy, the black camps. Nobody built latrines. Nobody made sure there was food and blankets passed out. Nobody took care of the sick. Because you don't have a community anymore. Without a community, you can't do anything. So we didn't have a community in Korea, in the camps. And out of 7,000 prisoners you had in Korea, almost half of them died. They didn't die because anybody shot them. They died from the fact that they were unable to function appropriately, to take care of themselves, to function as a community. They no longer had what you got to have and what black folk had taken from them through meritorious manumission. See, once you get a community, the next thing you must have above that is your trust. You cannot have trust if you don't have a community. And I always hear black folks say, Dr. Anderson, all the things you say are true, but how can I get together with another black when I don't trust them? You don't trust them because you don't have a community. And above trust comes cooperation. But Dr. Anderson, I don't want to work with him. No, because you don't trust him. So it goes community, trust, cooperation. And that's what they did in Korea. They killed the community. The black soldiers no longer had a community, and prisoners no longer had a sense of a community. They no longer had a sense of who they were. what they were about, the business of, and who they were. And all of a sudden, that kind of an oppressive system of rewarding people for identifying with the enemy, and that's what the Koreans are doing, saying you identify with us, and we'll reward you and give you a cannon and an apple. And when they started rewarding people, the community was destroyed. And their soldiers fell apart, and over half of them died. And so the next thing that happened to them is what also happened to the black community. After 1710, they moved into the thing what we call give-up-itis. All of a sudden, the soldiers in Korea, in those camps, no longer cared about anything anymore. So when I come into the Crenshaw district, and I said, why don't you do this? They said, well, we don't care anymore. Same thing happened in the prisoner of war camps. The soldiers didn't care. And once they lost caring, they were through. Nobody could save them anymore. And at night, over 40% of those soldiers would pull blankets over their head and just sit there in the corner and die for no apparent reason. Not for physical reasons. It was called give-up-itis, and you've seen it in hospitals. That's when a person would die long before he's supposed to. And you ask why. When a husband passed and the wife would die 6 months later, 3 months later, not for any medical reason, because they no longer have a will to live. And that's what happened in those camps. We lost over half our soldiers because they lost their will to live. And see, after meritorious manumission was put on black folk in 1710, black folk, a lot of them began to lose their will to live and to care and be responsible. So jumping back to 1710, so you understand what brainwashing is and the effect on black folk, I want you all to understand that was a re-educational system. So when that happened in 1710, the word spread. And down in Jamaica, there was a fellow named Willie Lynch that heard about it. And he was already running a seasoning school for slaves in the South, in Jamaica. So then he caught a boat and headed for America, headed for Virginia, where the meritorious manumission had been initially enacted. He got there in 1712. And just like the communists did in Korea, he came up with the same expression, gentlemen, I'm here to take care of your needs. I can show you how to do what you want to have done. I can show you how to divide these slaves so they'll never recover, or at least it'll take 300 years before they can do it. So some of you might wonder why I picked in my book the year 2013. This coming year in 2013 would be almost exactly 300 years since Willie Lynch put his methods on black folk. He said it would take 300 years. He said, what I'll do is to show you how you divide blacks. You divide blacks along the lines of skin color. You rig it so every black will look at another black skin color first and say, is he a yellow black or black black? And that way you've already divided them. You divide them along the lines of sex so that all of a sudden you'll have black women joining the feminist movement against their own black men. They're trying to beat them out of jobs and opportunity and visibility to take care of their families. So you divide them along the lines of sex. Then you divide them along the lines of age, where the old turn against the young turn against the old and say, you're ancient, you're old, I don't want to listen to you anymore. And it worked very effectively. And Willie Lynch put that on them. It's called divide and conquer. Divide and conquer was the same in 1710 as it was in 1950 in Korea. And black folk became invited. And so from 1750 up to about 1710 up to 1750, the system started going into effect. The social conditioning, the brainwashing of black folk took off full steam then. Because see now, they were very concerned about all these black slaves. We had to control them. And people said, well, how do you control, how are we going to control them? They said, the first way, and there are three ways you do it, but the first way is by physical control. Always control a black person physically. That's what slavery is about. The second way of controlling them was called Jim Crowism. Then you control them legally. Then the third way you control them is when we came out of the civil rights movement, which means symbolically. You control them by manipulating symbols. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. So they went into the first thing of controlling black folk physically with slavery. By 1750, the black population got up to 34% in America. And they were very concerned about this. Because you see, all these slaves were pouring in across the water, so they started advertising to bring in more immigrants. They said, what we need are more white immigrants to dilute. Remember, I told you the Diversity Act said we must have so many whites. So we got to have an immigration law that bring in more whites to neutralize blacks out, to keep them contained, to keep them in as a minority. We'll fix it so they'll love that word minority. They'll use it all the time and call themselves that. Even though we know the minority means loser. We'll turn the world upside down, they'll call themselves loser, loser, loser. So by 1750, black population hit 34%. So what the white society started doing then is that we must do what they didn't say that then, but the effect was the same. What happened in Korea? We must isolate them. So every Indian treaty from that point on started putting in conclusions saying that you must also stay away from black folk. They built into all the Indian treaties the incentives for them not to identify with black folk because they feared that if Indians and blacks got together, they could overthrow the country. So Indians were given incentives then to turn against black people. And that's why later on you find that the biggest killers of black folk for a long period of time were Indians. Because they were given incentives. For instance, if you raided a town or a village, guess who the first person you run into in the fields? Was a black person. And seeing you had laws because of the slave codes of 1705 says a black person could not arm himself, he couldn't carry a weapon, he couldn't carry a tool, he could not raise his hand to defend himself, he could not strike back. So Indians say, hey, we got a good guy to raid. I mean, this is like shooting ducks. And the whites knew that. When they put the blacks out in the field, they used blacks for burglar alarms. So every time it was an Indian raid, they the ones who went down first. And that's why all the five civilized tribes in America then became slaveholders. All the five civilized Indian tribes were slaveholders. Not only were they slaveholders, they were slave traders. And more important than that, in a treaty, they paid the Indians $20 for every runaway slave they chased down and brought him back. And that's why also when the Civil War came, all the five civilized tribes in America fought with the side of the South to prefer slavery because they didn't want to lose their money and wealth either. And I still have blacks running around saying, well, I'm half Indian. Nobody wants to be black. I mean, even if here's people that have been misusing your people too, but you don't want to be it. They'll tell me about how, well, I'm three-quarters white. I can't stand black folk. I'm three-quarters white. I said, well, why would you want to be white rather than black? I said, blacks didn't enslave you. Blacks didn't Jim Crow you. Blacks didn't castrate and lynch you and exploit you. And see, that's that upside down. We make black folks see things upside down and wrong. It's inappropriate behavior. Inappropriate behavior pattern was instituted on us to make sure we saw everything backwards. That way when we ran, we thought we were running the wrong right way, we were running the wrong way, and they knew it. And that's why you later hear me tell black folk all over America that my people, black folk, are doing everything wrong and not even doing wrong right. Because everything is pointed upside down for us, so they can't see which way to run. And so at that time, in 1750s, the colonies then tried to figure out how to contain the whole issue. So we got all our controls in place. We got the social conditioning in place, and I think we got blacks pretty well what we need them. We got them nailed down. So then they started telling England, don't send any more slaves over here to make sure it works. The Continental Congress sent all kinds of letters to England saying, don't send any more slaves. We'll make sure our system of control works. But England said, no, I'm gonna keep sending them. We're getting rich off of it. England said, we're making a fabulous amount of money because we set up the Navigation Act in 1650, which says, I don't care what you all produce in America, it must come back to England first to be processed, and you all buy it back from us. And when you buy it back from us, we're going to charge you three or four times the price of it. And so when England decided to have a revolutionary war to break away from England, they didn't put that in the history book, what the real reason they want to break away from England was for. One, because they were scared to death of black folk getting free over here and tying in with the Indians. Two, they wanted to reverse that whole shipping process, saying if we've made all the products in America, we raise the cotton, the corn, the beans, the rice, and everything, why are we sending it to you and buying it back from you? So that's what the Revolutionary War was over. And plus, that see, England was also getting rich off the slaves because, see, England was only paying $25, $35 a piece for every slave they were buying on the west coast of Africa, $25 to $35 a piece. But they created a system called capitalism, which says that I also want a 1,500% return on my money, my investment, which means if I pay $25 for a black slave on West Africa, I want to be able to sell them in America for $400 to $500 a piece. And so England was becoming a very rich and powerful nation. It's like most of it. But that was on not only England, but you had all the other slave companies, countries became richer. That was Portugal, Spain, England, Germany, and the Arab nations. All of them were becoming wealthy off of black folk, off a combination of two things, extracting the wealth out of Africa, the material wealth, and selling the human labor. And after the Revolutionary War, the first act of Congress, as soon as they set up a Congress in the United States, the first act of Congress said, let's solve this problem with the slaves. So the first thing they did was pass what they call the First Immigration Act that says this is a white nation, and the quota on blacks coming in here other than as a slave is zero. Zero, zip, none, nothing. And that stayed in effect until 1966 when it was raised to 0.5% or 1%. And I still see black folk displaying inappropriate behavior. They can't even figure out why you cannot get Haitians into the country. I said, God knows, don't you know what your law is? The reason you cannot get Haitians into the country is because they're still fearful of your getting a large, significant black population and being a threat to the society. I said, anytime you got boats floating around off the west coast of Africa for 3 months, you had over 3,000, 4,000 blacks on there who were sick, starving to death. Not one single country offered to bring them in, not this country. At the same time, this country has had refugee programs for every racial and ethnic extraction on earth but black folk. And where's our civil rights leaders? Where's our black leadership? Why aren't they raising issues about it? Instead of them going down there and say, why can't blacks come in from the islands and from Haiti? They do the same thing because they're seeing things upside down and backwards. They do the same thing the whites do. Say, well, what we need to do is invade that country and make them stay there. Let's improve the conditions there. And so that way they have nice places there. Rather than say, no, you didn't improve all the conditions in Mexico and El Salvador and Nicaragua and Hungary. And all these other countries, when the people came in, you didn't improve all the conditions in Vietnam to bring in the people. Why do you keep asking these special things, black? No leadership will raise the question. Because you see, no black leadership in America wants to raise the real issues about why we cannot raise our population and others can. In a social democracy where the majority will win and the minority will lose, we are the only planned, systematically, permanently, classified minority, which means that we are the only people who will always lose based on immigration laws and the quotas coming into this country, unless we start to develop some very specific ways of dealing with it. That's what powernomics is about. I started telling you, you got to start changing the rules, turn things back upside down. You got to always practice how do you get to be the majority. Never do anything where you're going to be a minority. Do it where you're going to become the majority. Don't move to be a minority. Move to be a majority. And we're going to talk about that a little later on how you play these games and learn how to win in Powernomics. But you see, as I said, by 1790, the law had locked us out as the only permanent loser. And they said that anybody losing the society from now on, it would be black people. They're the only people that cannot increase their population significantly to be a threat to this country. By the late part of 1790s, They said, what other kind of external controls can we put on black folk? Because now some of them want to try to join the religious movement in this country. And in religion, we say that everybody's a brother. And if we baptize them and make them a Christian, how do we deal with that fact? So they passed a law saying that Christianity did not relieve your heathenism for a black person. They did not want, and after that time, a few blacks had been going to church, but they were sitting in white churches, and they had to be monitored and watched, as I told you, because of the Diversity Act. So when the evangelical movement started moving through this country in the turn of the first of the early 1800s, they said, we'll let blacks have their churches, but we must pick the ministers, and we must license the ministers. We must pick ministers that we can control. No black preacher can come into America unless he is controlled by the white establishment, unless he represents our interests and our values, unless he teaches our form of Christianity. Now, this is very important. Why? Because, you see, before, religion was always used to help a population group. When it comes to blacks, we cannot let religion be used to help them. You see, the Catholics, church took after care of all those groups who call themselves Catholics. Jews, priests, took care of the Jews. And even today, you go into the conflicts in England or Ireland, where you see the Protestants and the Catholics fighting. I guarantee you that the Protestant members will be representing their people and protecting them. I guarantee you that the Catholic priests will be representing the Catholics and protecting them. If I take you into the Middle East with the Arabs, I guarantee you Khomeini will be taking care of Arabs. Only in America can I find black ministers who can be bought and sold to be against their own people. Nobody else will let you do that. No population will tolerate that except our people. And that's what I call inappropriate behavior. Inappropriate behavior pattern, when you let your own minister sell you out. It's not in your best interest. What I mean by sell you out is because by the early 1800s, the whites said, well, we're going to have black ministers. We've got to have to christen them to make sure they do what we want to have done. They must teach Christianity the way we want it taught, to where it is an external control device on black folk. They said, what are the rules? One, that every minister we license must teach black folk. If you talk about the slave and the master in the Bible, that you're talking about the white man and the black man on earth. Two, you must teach black, the minister must teach black folk that they're to be loyal, faithful, obedient, respectful, and all those other good things, and honest, so that white people don't have to worry about them stealing as a slave. Because, you know, black slaves had a nasty habit of going around stealing scraps of food because they were starving to death. And they would tell them, they must be industrious. But you see, white folks wanted you to work a little harder. So they used the term, he's a lazy slave. Now, anybody in his right mind got more than a third grade education would say, why would a slave want to be industrious? Why would you want to work hard as a slave? What's in it for you? Are you going to get released early? You can get a pension? Social Security, a retirement? But they always got this thing about, why, he's a lazy slave. I even got a black writer writes about that day. Well, part of the problem is the blacks were lazy slaves. He should have been lazy. The third thing they put on you is that, well, the black ministers must also teach them to get pie in the sky after death. They're going to turn their world upside down. So while everybody else is competing to get resources, to get wealth, to get power, black folk are saying, I'm waiting for mine in the sky. They said, well, the role model would be Jesus Christ. Says, yeah, Jesus Christ and all the Jews were very powerful people, had money. Solomon's the richest man on earth. You go look at Matthew, I think Matthew 23, when they start talking about the talent, where the different slaves had talents. And two of them went out and developed their talents and multiplied and made something. And one buried and hid his. Because they knew that would be that black one, would be that last one, go out and hide it. Y'all understand what I'm talking about? Now, but during that period of time, though, in the 1800s, when all this, they started putting all the religion on them, they started controlling them, a few blacks said, well, wait a minute now, because something just happened down in Haiti. Now, I know that I can guess in the future y'all aren't going to let the Haitians into this country, but in the 1800s, what happened was Toussaint Overture. Toussaint Overture took his little band of rabble-rousing blacks in Haiti and beat the devil out of all the French troops. Ran them raggedy. Beat the devil out of them. Now, that was important because for two reasons. First of all, that is the only time in Western history where the white society blinked and black folk took advantage of them and beat them. Y'all remember that? Only time in history that blacks ever broke free of that conditioning system I told you in 1710, the same one they used again in the Korean War. And again, the reason I want to point out that system to you, that brainwashing system, why is it so important? You all remember this and why it's so important. And that's why I must give the dominant white society praise for this. I mean, they're some very smart people. Very smart. Why did I say that? Because, you see, the people that put that system on black folk in 1710, they had the equivalent of a third or fourth grade education. And here we are today, 250 years later, or 200 some years later, almost 300, and black folk with doctor's degrees and master's can't even figure it out. Now, but little Toussaint Louverture down in Haiti, he won his battle, beat them good. Now, that meant when he beat them, though, they finally tricked him and said, well, now that we are, that you've beaten us, wouldn't you like to come together and integrate? He went to discuss it with them at a meeting. They captured him, put him on a boat, and shipped him to someplace in Europe, some country way up in Iceland, one of those, I think Finland or someplace. And it froze him to death up there in the prison. Because he went to co-op. And I told you in Korea. In the Korea and the brainwashing techniques, there's another principle that says that anytime you want to control anybody, I can control anybody who's willing to talk and compromise and discuss with me. I can get him to compromise. And see, what we said, we're trying to teach our soldiers was called a code of conduct in Korea, which says never, never talk to your enemy. Unless it's on your turf and your terms. And see, right now, I'm assistant police commissioner, I'm working as a therapist for prisoners. Anytime I get somebody to communicate and talk with me, I got him. If he'll speak to me and answer my questions, I got him. Sooner or later, he's going to break down and tell me what I want him to know. The way you resist is you don't communicate. You don't compromise your principles. They can never beat you then. And see, and that's how they got Overture. They asked him, don't you want some integration? Like they told our leaders, the same thing. Now, there were some other blacks who jumped and said, I'm not going to go for that okey-doke. And one of the first ones in 1800 was Gabriel Prosser. Gabriel was an extremely smart black guy. He says, I just heard about what Toussaint Overture did down in the islands. And said, if Toussaint can do it, I'm going to do it here. He said, I'm going to do the same thing. And he did some planning, and you couldn't believe. He worked, he planned, he schemed. Prosser really worked on his thing. And he planned one of the most devastatingly, strategically well-planned insurrections on earth. Now, before I tell you what he did, let me go back and make this point. I tracked between 1710 in 1860, and we had a possible 150 to 200 possible slave revolts. And in all 150 to 200 of them, a black person squealed in every one of them and got his meritorious manumission and his Willie Lynch badge card. And so when Prosser was trying to pull his together, he planned his scheme. And when the day he was supposed to have his big revolt, would you believe one of the most severe storms that had ever hit Virginia came in and washed out most of the land and roads and bridges, and Prosser's group couldn't get together at their gathering point because they were planning on hitting three things. They were planning on taking over the penitentiary in Richmond. They were planning on taking over the armory, and they were planning on attacking the town and annihilating the town, everybody except the Methodists and the Quakers who had befriended them. And the storm struck just as they were going to assemble. And only 300 showed up, and Prosser said, well, since only 300 of us here, let's put it off until next week when the land is dry and clear. And within 3 days, a black person squealed. Prosser was arrested, along with 35 of his supporters. They were executed, hanging heads, chopped off, and put on poles. But the two blacks that did the squealing, one was called Tom, the other was called Farrell. And God knows it, because I don't know, why is the name of a black person Tom you almost guess he's going to do something. Now, I don't know, and I don't mean to put down anybody here named Tom, but I don't know something about that name. And Pharaoh itself is not too much of an exciting name. I wouldn't trust that name either. If somebody, my mother named me Pharaoh, I'd know I'm in a world of trouble too. But anyway, Tom and Pharaoh turned in Prosser. They executed Prosser, chopped his head off, along with some other, and hung him up on poles. But the thing that became very important in that case, though, was that the town was really fearful because they found out from rumors that Prosser had lined up somewhere between 5 and 50,000 slaves. The whites all through Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina was paralyzed. Their mouths fell open, their eyes just popped, and they said, something is wrong. You mean tell me we put a conditioning system on black folk where we turn everything upside down? And this black guy was able to do the impossible without an education? Something is wrong with our system. What's wrong? And I'm serious. This was a big issue. They had to find out how this one black guy get together as a slave and have something between 5 and 50,000 blacks ready to fight, and had not been for a storm, they'd have taken over the country. And finally came out to another rumor, speculations, that what it was that he had beat the symbolism. To show you how important symbols are, that's why I keep telling about powernomics. To get out of your system, sometimes you're lost. You look up at a mountain. You look up at a peak. You look for the Penobscot building or the Empire State Building. You find your symbol and you can find your direction. And what that black done, Prosser done, he looked at the state seal. The state of Virginia had a seal where it had a white man lying prostrate and a black man's foot on his chest. White and the black guy were called, and in the seal it said, Verticus overcomes Tyrannus. And that black man had used that seal as his motivating force, his guiding light for his people. And when whites found that out, immediately they changed the Virginia seal and said, get rid of that seal fast. And put up guards around the Capitol to make sure it didn't happen again. Now that was in 1800. By 1821, another black named Vesey got equally as concerned. He had heard about it. He said, he's going to try it in South Carolina and try another revolt. But Vesey says up front, Vesey organized his group. He walked around. He was a free black. He got free because he bought his own, paid $600 and freed himself. He won money in a lottery. But he's very upset because he couldn't buy his children out of slavery. So Vesey would walk through the town in Charleston, South Carolina, telling black folk, get that hump out of your back. Straighten up. Be respectful. Take care of your own people. Look out for your own people. Quit trying to worry about everybody and look out for yourselves. And Vesey was he was a big man, too, a big, broad man. He said, I'll break your back if I catch you bending over. And he planned an insurrection. And he called something like about 300 to 500 together to take over Charleston, South Carolina. But he told them up front, he said, let me tell you all something. He says, if I catch one black in this group trying to get meritorious manumission, he said, I'm going to snap your neck like a twig. And he planned a revolt. And unfortunately, again, 2 days before his revolt was supposed to occur, not only was he squealed on once, he was squealed on twice. So Vesey was picked up along with about 37 of his people and hung. Because, again, they sold him out. Then by 1831, Nat Turner, you already know about, tried the same thing a few years later, in 31. Nat Turner says that I'm not even going to go through those changes. I'm not going to do what VC did. I'm not going to do what Prosser did. I'm not even going to play that silly game. He said, what am I going to do? He said, I'm going to break out of here. I'm getting me a knife, gun, sword, stick, tools, bricks, anything I can get. I'm killing anything I see that moves, crawls, jumps, walks, or talks. That's exactly what I'm quoting him. He says, I'm the rod and staff of God. I'm not playing these silly games. I'm tired. And so Turner started walking, saying he was a sword and the voice of God. And he said, I'm going to kill anything I see moving. He killed 55 people, including his own master. And then the country got petrified again and sent the army in looking for him. They searched for Nat Turner for 2 months and couldn't find him. He hid out because he killed so many people. Until one day he needed food and went down to get some blacks to get some food. And guess what happened? Turned him in. And so that took care of Nat Turner. Same time as one other black, though, which is my hero. I don't know how much time I got. How much? As long as I want. Okay. Okay, thank you. You see, you all are so nice. That's why I love coming to this city. Boy, I swear. I love you. I'm going to move out here pretty soon. But my hero is John Horse. We start talking about inappropriate behavior versus appropriate behavior. Now, here's a black man at the same time period displayed what I call appropriate behavior. No Rodney King stuff, you see? John Horse was a runaway slave who had also run off to Florida in the early 1800s in the same period when V.C. and Turner and the rest of them were trying to revolt. John Horse was a big, burly, strong black man. He ran off to Florida. Contrary to what you hear all the time in the media about the Underground Railroad, all blacks trying to get north, get to the promised land. That's a part of that myth. Most blacks weren't that dumb. Why would they want to go all the way across go to the north 1,000 miles through hostile white country when they could run off to Florida, which is Spanish territory, 20 miles away or 2 feet away? So some of the smarter blacks of our relatives ran off to Florida because that was Spanish territory. And they got out and they interbred and intermixed with the Seminole. Now, you all might ask me why about Seminole. Now, Seminoles were also against blacks, a lot of them, but a lot of them were not. Seminoles were the most receptive blacks, receptive Indians to do anything with blacks in the country. Why? Because you see, the word Seminole means runaway slave. Okay? And they were also runaways. They interbred with blacks. They were a mixture of blacks. So they were very receptive to black folk. And so they started fighting in that area to fight the United States because the United States didn't want to go down there and try to get the slaves back. And that's what they were sending General Andrew Jackson to Florida for, to get the slaves. Because you see, blacks down there were coming across the border periodically with the Indians raiding and killing whites and getting their people free. Now, why is that important? Because you see, when I talked about early inappropriate behavior in Africa, the reason they enslaved black folk originally was because our leaders in Africa had given the impression that I don't care about other black folk. And they hauled all those blacks around the world because they knew in their hearts they would never see a shipload of Africans coming to get them back. They never suspected that Africans would come to save Africans. But that's why they didn't try to enslave Indians, because they knew if they didn't enslave Indians, Indians would come get their people. But they knew that black leadership in Africa had already said, you can have them, I don't want them, I won't come to get them. And so when the blacks went off into Florida, they were coming across the border, raiding those plantations along Alabama and the Georgia border there, South Carolina border, taking their people, taking them back to down to Florida, getting them free. But John Horse was a leading hero to me. Now this black hooked up, he became sort of like the second in charge in Africa, in Florida. The chief at that time during the 1820s and 1830s was a chief named Osceola. Osceola had about 3 sons that were very active also fighting white intrusion into Florida to get the slaves back. His number one son was a white, a mixture of black and white. His name was Wildcat. And Osceola himself, if you all don't know it, Osceola was married to a black woman. You might see Osceola's pictures in all the museums as an Indian. They don't ever tell you that he was married to a black woman and had a mixed group. And he married to a black woman. His black woman's name was Morning Dew, if you're interested in knowing it. Morning Dew was the one, and that's what triggered the Seminole Wars. They don't tell you that in the history books either. So going back and forth down there, they were trying to get the Indians back. Trying to get the slaves back from the Indians. And they kept sending the federal troops in there. And Andrew Jackson was one of the primary generals that always wanted to go out there and fight Indians. He loved to fight Indians. He's known as the Indian fighter. And that's why you have Jacksonville, Florida. because he was going in there again fighting Indians and trying to get blacks back. And on the Chattahoochee River right outside Tallahassee, they had a fort there called Fort Negro, where most of the blacks were living, staying there. And they sent the federal troops down there to get the slaves back. Then the federal boat came up the Chattahoochee River to Fort Negro, and most of the blacks were out with the Indians raiding and fighting, and left the women and kids there. And so the federal troops fired on Fort Negro, one shot, and a shot rolled into the armory and set off the explosion and blew up the entire fort, and there was nothing in there but black women and children. And that really made them hostile. The blacks were hostile this time. So now, that triggered the second Seminole War. After that, they decided to have a truce. They said, we'll have a truce if we sit down with Osceola and his warriors, John Horse and the rest of them. At that point in time, they met. Before they met, they went and kidnapped Morning Dew and told Osceola that if you want your wife back, you better turn some of those black slaves loose and meet with us. And when Osceola went to the meeting to discuss getting his wife back, they kidnapped him and put him in prison. I think up in Fort Sumter, South Carolina, he died of consumption and exposure. And so at that point in time, John Horse and Wildcat went berserk. Then they started fighting. They fought all the way throughout Florida and finally ran them out of Florida. They went out west and led whole movement called the Trail of Tears all the way out to Oklahoma Territory. But the only people who were fighting in this country against the United States at that time was John Horse and Wildcat and his band of blacks. They had carried their own women and kids with them. That is the only black man in the history of this nation, and I'm sorry to say no school teaches that. That's the only black man in America that's ever stood up to America and fought him, and not as a slave, but as a man. Nobody else has ever done it. John Horse fought the United States for 50 years. They fought him all out west. They chased him all down through the west, through Oklahoma, through Texas, and finally chased him into Mexico. He went into Mexico and stayed there for about 5 or 6 years and came back again, he and Wildcat. They tried to set up their little village again, but the whites out there, the racists, kept raiding their camp, shooting them and killing them. He kept fighting, and they finally killed Wildcat, shot him in the back with a shotgun and killed him. And then the John Horse finally just gave up and got on his horse, allegedly, and just rode off back into Mexico. You never heard from him again. But he fought for 50 years, the only black man. You can talk about any civil rights leader you want to. If you had a hero, that's the only hero we ever had that fought and says, I'm not a slave and I won't take it. I'm not Rodney King or anybody else. Nobody ever knew what happened to him, but he rode off. That was John Horse. Now, this whole meritorious manumission policy is in effect, moving along at the same time, this control system. About 1852, a lady named Harriet Beach Stover wanted to write about it. So she then wrote about the whole thing. She interviewed a guy whose name was Henson, which you all know as Uncle Tom. He then told about the story. She wrote a book called Uncle Tom's Cabin. But in that book, contrary to what most people think, Uncle Tom was not the bad guy. The bad guy was Sambo. And so I'm asking you all, as my brothers and sisters, please in the future don't call a black guy who you know is worthless and trifling, don't call him an Uncle Tom, that's complimenting him. Call him his real name, what he's entitled to, and that's a Sambo. Any black person sells his own people out and will do them in, he is a Sambo. Now, what is a Sambo again? Going back to meritorious manumission in 1710, the whole conditioning process, the whole brainwashing system, the whole social engineering system says that you must teach black people to see the world through the eyes of whites. You must see everything through their eyes. You must accept their values, their superiority, whatever they think and feel, and that way we got you contained. And that's why when you see somebody like Colin Powell talking about running for office, they say, well, you can run for office if you see the things the way we want to see them. If you want to be conservative, you can run for office. If you want to place a lot of importance on abortion, you can run for office. If you want to talk about being anti-taxes, you can run for office, which means if you see things the way we see them as a black person, you're safe. You're acceptable. And if you don't want to do that way, then become an athlete or an entertainer. So therefore, you don't you identify with the rest of those blacks in the country. You stay away from them. They're bad. And you start going on, you try to go get a penny out of an athlete and entertain and do something for the black community. They're going to do it. Their advisors won't let them do it. The agents won't do it. Their promotion people won't let them do it. They're going to identify with your community because, again, they have now already died and gone to heaven. Okay, so when Harriet Beecher Stowe put out her book, what she tried to tell black folk is that Uncle Tom was not a bad guy. See, Uncle Tom, if you read that book, and most blacks, 90% of blacks never read it. They always call another black, he's an Uncle Tom, he's an Uncle Tom. He's not an Uncle Tom. If you read the book Uncle Tom, Uncle Tom was a guy who would not beat black women. Uncle Tom, that book, was a guy who would not beat other blacks to make them pick more cotton. Uncle Tom was a guy who would come in at night and take cotton out of his own bag and put it in other black folks' bags so they wouldn't get whippings at night. Uncle Tom was a guy who would not tell where black folk were hiding when they went across the river and they broke free as slaves. But Simon Legree, the white slave master, had a black to follow him around named Sambo, who always says, you show me, give me the right, I'll show you how to tease the coons. I'll show you where they hide. And see, and that's the guy. See, his role responsibility was going back to meritorious manumission. I told you about when you got to protect white folks' property and protect their wealth. He says, I will protect it and find it for you. And that's why you read in those end of the movies and books that came out after Uncle Tom, you always had a black guy, a black slave, running down the road saying, Master, Master, here comes the army. Let's hide our silver and gold. And you all said, our? How did it get to be our? You know, he always wanted to say something that doesn't even belong to him. And that showed up all through history. And today you got the same kind of personality doing it. And now he's not saying, let's hide our silver and gold. He's called himself a conservative. I'm also against affirmative action for black folk. I'm against quotas. I'm against preferential treatment. Even had one running around talking about he wanted to pass a law to stop black folk from discriminating against whites. You still got that kind of personality that always wants to protect something, protect the strong. You always got that kind of Sambo personality. And nowadays, the best way to get rich is to say, I'm going to practice that master's gold and silver, and I'm going to be against them black folk. I guarantee I can get you a radio talk show. I can get you a television show. I can even get you an appointment to the Supreme Court. Okay? You tell me how many black folk you want to sell out, and I guarantee I'll show you how to make money. Because you see, every ethnic group, every religious group, every racial group, every political group has always made money off of black folk. Okay? And what I'm going to start talking about in Powernomics when I come back here in the fall is to show you all one thing. I'm going to tell you is time is up. You have made, as a race, you made every religion, every ethnic group, every racial group rich. There is nobody else left on earth to make rich but yourselves. So that's all left. We got to do it for ourselves now. So don't give me this stuff about Dr. Anson. That's the reverse discrimination. We are anti. You ain't anti nobody. You already made everybody rich. They always tell me, well, Dr. Anson, what you're preaching is isn't that a segregation? Or let me tell y'all something. Starting again, back in 1850, blacks got hung up on that same mess. You know. By 1850, after Harriet Beecher Stowe put out her book, here comes Frederick Douglass. He's going to take one path. He's going to go back now and try to pick up becoming an integrationist. He becomes an integrationist, taking that, he wants, well, since they excluded us in 1638 saying we should never be permitted to enjoy the fruits of white society, let's be integrationists and civil rights people. Let's make them let us in. So they started that top strand called integrationists, which are run Frederick Douglass, Booker T. Washington, then up to all your civil rights leaders and Martin Luther King and that whole group, all the way down the line to even your present-day civil rights groups. They keep saying, we want access to whatever you own. We want to be included in whatever you own. Now you got another group that started after the book with Harriet Beecher Stowe. They said they want to be segregationists. Then you got the more strongly willed persons like W.B. Du Bois. Then you got Martin Delaney. You got Marcus Garvey. Then you got Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad. They were going the other way saying, no, we want our separate stuff. Now, what I say by myself, and I know a lot of people might get upset when I say it, both groups were right and both groups were wrong. What I say is that it is not about integration. It is not, the issue is not segregation. The issue is congregation. It means aggregating. What it is called functional pluralism, which means we are not trying to integrate, we're not trying to segregate. No other group comes here and says, I want to integrate or segregate. What they're saying is that if I come together and concentrate as a people, concentrate my power and my wealth and my resources, I can compete. That's what they're talking about. And please, as I love all of you, and I'm going to move here with you, don't let them trick you all anymore with them upside-down glasses. They used to ask me that during integration about Dr. Anderson. Now, hold it. Now, you're at the governor's office in Florida. You represent the whole state in education. Now, what do you want during integration? Do you want, you got Malcolm X talking about segregation. You got Martin Luther King talking about integration. Why don't you all make up your mind? Which do you want? I said, I don't want either one. I want the same rights and privileges that everybody else got to go to either one of the sticks. Don't try to put me on one end of the stick. What I want more than anything else is to bring my people together and say, get all the power and wealth together like everybody else. And that way, now quit trying to give us, try to define us. You see, every Asian, for instance, when he leaves his homeland, he comes to America. He looks in the mirror and says, I'm going to America. And when I get to America, I'm going to find me a community of people that either look like me, or I'm going to build me a community of people that look like me, that have my values, my culture, and my language. Nobody asked him about integration or segregation. When Hispanics come to this country, they would say, I'm going in, I'm going to build me a community of people that look like me or sound like me. And like the Asians who set up Little Havanas, who set up Little Cambodias, Little Vietnam, Chinatowns in every city. The Hispanics come in, they'll build Little Mexicos, Little Havanas, Little Hialeahs. I can go across America and find German towns, French towns, Greek towns, Polish towns, but I can't find a black town. Because of our inappropriate behavior pattern with the Rodney kids, we keep trying to integrate. Nobody else is trying to integrate. Why would you try to integrate? And I just told you in 1790, the law says in the Constitution that the majority will win and the minority will lose. If the majority will win and the minority will lose, why would you ever do anything that breaks yourself into smaller pieces when you already a plan systematically programmed the minority? Now you got other people in a category called minority. You got women, gay, Hispanic, anything you want. Midgets, Hispanics, anything you want. But nobody goes by there and say how many you can have. You've ever heard anybody say we can only have so many women in the country, or so many midgets in the country, or so many gay in the country, or so many AIDS. The only thing they say is you must have is so many blacks. We are the only people. And see, another thing you got to understand, I told you last time I was here, is that you got to remember that you are the only non-immigrants in America. The only non-immigrants. So when you start using a word for yourself, always call yourself a non-immigrant. Don't call yourself anything else other than that. Don't call yourself a minority. And to some degree, if you really want to be slick, I wouldn't even call myself an African-American. Why not? I asked a girl, one girl in Texas, but she said, I know you never call yourself an African-American. She said, I'm very, I said, why? She said, why is that? I said, because I'm black, you see? She said, but why, but aren't you still an African-American? I said, no. Because you see, when I go look at the definition of African-American, the whole north part of Africa is a continent. That's not a country, that's a continent. People coming in from El Salvador, and they're El Salvadorians. When you say you're from Africa, I'm an African, where in Africa? Do y'all understand what I'm saying? Where in Africa? And plus that, and worse than that, is that the whole north part of Africa, those coming in the country, they are Arabs. Palestinians, Chaldeans, Egyptians, they're classified, those are whites coming in, but they also call themselves African Americans. When I go down through different parts of the west coast of Africa, I got people coming in from west coast of Africa. They are Pakistanis and Indians, East Indians, but they call themselves African Americans. When I go down to whites coming in from South Africa, they call themselves African Americans. And what they've done again is smother the issue over. So when I go look at it, when I go break it open, it's like cracking open an egg, like when I look inside the word minority, I look inside of African America. I find the number of blacks that came into the country last year out of 26,000 African Americans, I only find something like 4,000 blacks. And that's why they're going to put the moves on you again. What they want to do is to cover it up again so you can't figure out what's happening to black folks. So a new term, they're going to say, well, we buried a lot of them under minorities, that concept. We buried a lot of them under the term Afro-American. Now let's come up with another term called multicultural. And Asiatic or Asian or something, where nobody know what they are anymore. And see, if we bury them, see, nobody know what the conditions are for them anymore. They can't figure it out either. And see, that way we lock in the structural inequities. If racism, slavery, and Jim Crowism made whites 50-foot giants, and your problem is that whites got this much, you got that much, if you bury everything and smother it over, you'll never figure it out. You all gonna have to fight from now on to make sure that it's only black. Every issue is black, so you can find out what's happening to your people. They're gonna try to bury it because whites now got a choice. Either correct the structural inequities or hide it. And it's much cheaper to hide it. And one of the easiest way of hiding it is to co-opt your leadership. To pay off the black leadership and bring them inside the circle, and they're not gonna make issues over anything. Instead of functioning on your problem is the structural inequities. The structural inequities are so bad in America, and they have been so bad since slavery, that civil rights and integration can't even reach black folk. They're so badly damaged and hurt. And I don't know why the blacks keep running around talking about we want civil rights and equality. You can't get equality if you're unequal. Unless, again, they put those glasses on you and turn them upside down, and all of a sudden you begin to see unequal as being equal. The worst kind of racism is the racism that pretends that unequals are equals. And that's what they've done to you. And they got this whole new concept called a colorblind society. And what colorblind society means, let's be blind to black folk, pretend we don't see them. And they're hiding and smothering it again for you. And that's what it means. Now, where did that come from? It came from some of the white civil rights think tanks out of Washington. After the civil rights movement, what they wanted to do was say, let's bury the issue with black folk. And they gave our civil rights leaders a chance after the civil rights movement that made the difference. They didn't take it. Our black leadership displayed inappropriate behavior coming out of the civil rights movement. Throughout the civil rights movement, when they should have been focusing on the real issue, they didn't do it. Instead of focusing on correcting the historical damage that had been inflicted on black folk, they started messing around with civil rights and integration. And never touched the problem. Ran all over the country thinking that by taking down the signs over the water fountains or the bathrooms about colored only or black only, that they were dealing with racism. They didn't even touch racism. Racism was three stories down. Getting a black folk to sit in a white restaurant or sit on the front of a bus has no meaning at all. The second thing they did was they never had a plan. They ran all over the country from one demonstration, one march to the next one, never had a national plan about what they're going to do when they get there and what the next generation of blacks are going to do. And thirdly, they never built an institution to carry out a national plan. And when they did that, whites then changed their policy on blacks. They figured out black folk have displayed this inappropriate behavior and missed the boat. So what they did then, they said, let's put the moves on them. Johnson then wrote a law saying, you got to correct the conditions of black folk in 1965, what's called the Affirmative Action Bill. When that came out, they put the moves on us to smother the issue again. Affirmative action was supposed to have been intended to correct those structural inequities between blacks and whites that have occurred as a direct result of all those years of things I'm talking about. As soon as the bill came out, whites immediately started changing it and black leadership bought it. The issue was supposed to be going this way. Watch how they flip the glasses upside down on you. The issue was supposed to be correcting historical discrimination, what has happened to blacks historically by racism and discrimination. They switch and say, let's not talk about historical, let's talk about present day and the future. You're supposed to have been dealing with racism, which means group-based. They said, no, forget about that. Let's deal with individual discrimination. The issue was supposed to have been focusing on dealing with things that have happened to black folk. They changed the law. Let's deal with issues pertaining to everybody. Women, gays, handicapped, everything else. And when they did that, they destroyed affirmative action. Don't even waste your time even chasing affirmative action anymore. It's been destroyed. It was supposed to be helping black folk. Now, what the other groups did, they said now that somebody put out a law to help black folk, how do we become equal to blacks? And that's when the Hispanics jumped up this thing called Hispanic, the concept. Before that, we didn't have anything called Hispanic. But they thought in the early 60s that black folk might get some out of the civil rights movement. So what they did, they went to the table and came up with a whole term called Hispanic. They said, let's go all over the world and find everybody that speaks Spanish and pretend they're equal to black folk. And let's pretend that the Spanish language has been handicapped, Jim Crowed, enslaved, hung, lynched, decapitated, and everything else, and therefore is entitled to be treated like a black person. And they fabricated a new race called Hispanics. So now that means any person coming from Spain, Portugal, Philippines, any place, say, I'm a Hispanic, I'm equal to black folk. And the worst part about it, and then every time you hear a report about poverty, they'll go compare Hispanic poverty with black poverty. Nobody ever stopped it. Hold a second. You got to quit playing that game. You're smothering the issue. The poverty on black folk is poverty that's been there for 400 years. That's the same old poverty you've been dealing with for 400 years, and you got rolling poverty. You keep having Hispanics coming into the country and comparing the poverty they're bringing into this country with the poverty that's been with black folk for 400 years. Nobody wants to stop them from doing that. Now people say, they got poverty. Yes, but that's poverty they bring in here with them. Black folk didn't bring poverty with them. It was given to us as a gift. Right. If you were to go back to 1840s, where I was earlier talking about Uncle Tomism, back at that point in time, you did not have one single solitary Hispanic in the entire United States. But you had almost 5.5 million black folk that were enslaved, who had been enslaved for 250 years. You didn't have any Hispanics. By 1900, you had 100,000 Hispanics in the United States, but you got 11 million black folk. Now, they got the same identical birth rate in 1900 up until today. Same identical birth rate. You got 100,000 Hispanics and 11 million black folk, and now they're going to pass black folk. Now, somebody who can count past three should say, hold a second. How can you only have 100,000 of them in 1900 at the same birth rate, and you got 11 million blacks and now passing blacks? Because 2 million every year walking across the border. It is not this country's responsibility to be correcting all their poverty. It is the country's responsibility to correct the poverty they put on people. The poverty, and see, if you go through history, you cannot find one single solitary instance where anybody else in this country have been denied access to the educational system, to the economic system, to the political system, to the social system, but black folk. Don't you let anybody compare themselves with you. And that's why I said a few minutes ago, use terms that isolate you and reconnect you with your history and give you a special uniqueness so that nobody can piggyback off of you. Use the word non-immigrant. If you're gonna do wrong right. If you want to insist, For those in the audience who want to insist on using the word minority, then at least qualify and say we are the only involuntary minority. Or we are the only planned minority. But don't and don't let use this term where it means everybody collectively. Because the whole concept of minority means to confuse the issue and defuse any resources you could have gotten. Now, where does that come from as a minority? Let's deal with that concept a second. Now, at this point in time, black people have to understand in America that if you go back to the Constitution I was talking to you about earlier, the Federalist Papers were the document upon which the Constitution was drafted. The Federalist Papers said this, that if you're going to have a social democracy where the rule is that the majority will win and the minority will lose, then the majority has some obligations. First of all, if you use that social democracy that we're currently using, the majority have these obligations. One, it is the majority's responsibility to protect the rights of the minority. It is not your right as a minority to keep going out here marching and demonstrating. It is the dominant white society to make sure you got everything you need. That's their obligation. Point two in the Federalist Papers that built gave the structure for the Constitution, it also says that if you use a social democracy like we have in the United States, that you cannot do anything to stop the minority from becoming the majority. And immediately, after that Constitution went into effect, within a year, they enacted the immigration law to put a zero quota on blacks to make sure they stay a minority. They violated the Constitution in 1 year to make sure that you become a permanent minority. And I have not heard one black legal scholar in the United States make that an issue. None of them made it an issue. That's inappropriate behavior on the part of our legal scholars in this country. And thirdly, in the Federalist Paper, it says, and if you fail to protect, the majority fails to protect the rights of the minority, and if you do something to impede the minority from becoming the majority the same way you became the majority, then thirdly, that minority has no rights to abide by your laws and your rulings. Now think about that. Now I want to know where all my black scholars and my black legal minds, why aren't you displaying appropriate behavior and investigating that, find out why it is that you got the minority running around trying to protect itself when you know good and well it doesn't have the power and resources to do it. That's like trying to have a baby to look out for himself when you know he cannot go out and work a job and fix his own food. It's your obligation to take care of him. But nobody raised it as an issue in this country. Where all my black legal scholars should be raising issues over the fact that in this country, that the 13th Amendment that was given to black folk, that was supposed to free black folk, was never enforced. The Emancipation Proclamation was supposed to free blacks. That's what they say in the myth. But it wasn't. The Emancipation Proclamation by Lincoln was only to free those blacks that he had no authority over in the first place. He was talking about any black who's in a state that broke away from the United States, you're free. He doesn't have that authority, just broke away. Now the blacks he could have freed that was still in slavery on the north side, he didn't do anything about them. To this day, they never corrected that. Legitimately, they are still enslaved. Secondly, if you put out the 13th Amendment, freeing people, let's go to the 14th Amendment. If you go to the 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment saying they hereby forbade any kind of involuntary servitude, then they stuck a clause in there, except when duly have been prosecuted and charged. You know what that means? What that meant was then that any white in the South who wanted to re-enslave black folk, all they'd do is come up with a charge and he can re-enslave you. And what the South did immediately after the 14th Amendment went into process, they passed what's called a Black Codes in 1865 and 66. The Black Codes then said that any black person who used to be a slave, who's now free, he must be able to show me he has a contract for employment in his hand by the 1st of January. Or therefore, I can arrest you and charge you with vagrancy and put you back into a plantation and enslave you again. Now, all the people knew that. They didn't raise any cane about it. Today, that's still a part of our Constitution. I don't hear my black scholars. Where's the appropriate behavior? Now, why is that important now when I talk about appropriate behavior? Because now there's a bill on the Hill where some white conservatives now want to lay claim to the 14th Amendment and say they're going to write a law saying called Equal Opportunity Act. What they're going to say now is that that bill can be used for whites too, so that you can now not infringe on their rights. And what black folks should have done is gone back to the Slaughterhouse case in 1872, which says that the 14th Amendment was strictly written for black people. That's what, see, in other words, whites are using the 14th Amendment for reverse discrimination charges against black folk. Now, you all follow me through on this. How can you allow somebody, if something is written on this side to help save you from this guy, how can you let him take the same law and knock your brains out on the other side with it? Am I losing you all on this now? But how can whites come around now and claim use of the 14th Amendment that was written to protect black folk from whites? And now whites are taking it and use it to hit blacks with it. Where are my black lawyers and judges? And you got a black sitting on the Supreme Court now, it keeps ruling, talking about he's...
the alarm as it was boiling over with consternation among the people, forcing the hand of men who would see to their God-given rights. The root of the problem was far deeper than an inability of inter-ethnic relations. The source derived from political exploits and legal ramifications that proved to be frail and fraudulent. The same would inevitably keep the nation in a continual chaotic state of some sorts. And how frightening it is to know that even in our present time, political, legal, and economic exploitation maintains common place in the dark havens of our democracy. Iron wheel of Reverend Nathaniel Turner, pounding the pavement with troops swollen with prophetic indignation against all odds. It is the packed sales in the rest of 60s, making headlines on TV to voice prophetic grievances, not to tickle ears and appeasement, revolutionary statesmanship, as found embodied in General Toussaint Louverture on the shores of Haiti. Setting political holds and ideological strongholds on who's capable, who is a conqueror, or more succinctly, who is also a man. We are called to continue in his legacy, unashamed to denounce political figures by name. Are we afraid and ashamed to lose tax exemptions if we truly preach in his name in America? And who is speaking prophetic truth to power and making our world a morally better place? These are my thoughts, not just for my tomorrow, but for our tomorrow. Future in our hands, ours for the taking, shaping,